This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Have you been to Australia? I've been there once. I know people think I'm from there, but I'm actually at the bottom tip of Africa, Cape Town.
No, I've never been there. That's one of the sides of the earth I guess I haven't been to. I've been to the Philippines. I've been to Singapore, but then that's it, really. I haven't explored any of the...
You haven't come to my continent?
Nope.
Okay, you have to come.
That's a lot of business. I spent a lot of time in the EU. I've been to Russia and all the way to Lake Baikal. New Zealand and Australia is one of the only ones. And I haven't been to Africa either, but that's also a pretty...
Dude, you got to come. Yeah. I'll show you around Cape Town. It is a great, great place. It's nothing like you see in the media, which I think you should know by now. By the way, I'm not sure what side of the fence you are on. Do I congratulate you or commiserate?
I'm on kind of neither side of the fence. I work now under the assumption that nobody's allowed to get anywhere near that place without already participating, unfortunately.
You're talking about the White House, Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and social media, you know, prominence and TV spots. This is all stuff that's now exclusively the only card-carrying members of the governing elite are allowed to be there. Everybody else is auditioning for it.
Yeah, it's a stage with actors on it.
Yeah, actors that actually work together more than a lot of people think. I think that's the most important illusion to break.
But what you're telling me, though, is that your new actor at least can read full sentences.
did you get the feeling at all that Kamala was such a bad candidate that it almost seemed impossible?
You know, there is something that I was wondering about. It was though... the entire establishment was pushing for this particular outcome. Do you think that's what they did?
It sure feels like it to me. I mean, now that I've kind of stepped back and realized how I was played during the pandemic, I've started to see this kind of tactic in a lot more places, a lot easier. And one of those places, definitely in politics.
I use the analogy or the metaphor, battle of ideas, but it really is a battle, an information war.
Yeah, it's an information war that we really need to understand exactly how it's waged, or we'll think we're fighting, but we actually aren't. That's the quite terrifying part for me, because for the first good 3 years of the pandemic, I thought I was fighting when actually I was absolutely positively trapped in their hamster wheel, just like they wanted us to be. In fact, I was participating in trapping other people in their hamster wheel, which is how that kind of thing works. They have tossed around this notion of mass psychosis, but in reality, that's what they induced in us. And then we brought ourselves and our family and our friends into it, whether they agreed with us or not. They were sucked into this vortex of bad ideas from which there's really no escape until you realize that that vortex is created exclusively for our governance. It's been a long road because I did not understand that even the biological underpinnings of what I thought I understood as an academic biologist are actually largely based on this same mythology from which the pandemic is generated. And so that part of it has actually also given me new direction, because at the beginning of this whole mess, I kind of thought I was solving a mystery. And so that when the mystery was solved or when I convinced people, then this job would be over. But now I've come to understand it as a much bigger issue with a much probably longer time horizon in terms of how long we're going to have to push back against this set of ideas and make sure that our children don't teach them to our grandchildren. Because that's what this is about. We inherited a lot of these bad ideas from our parents, and it wasn't necessarily their fault, because there were only a few TV stations and only a few newspapers, and those things were used against our parents to give them a certain idea of the biological world, the medical reality that we lived in. And so I don't think it would have been possible for my parents, for example, to see through a vaccine schedule that they grew up with and then changed in the early 80s. It would have been impossible for my parents to see through it when for their whole lives America was seen as this kind of cutting edge best case scenario. So anything that we were doing was assumed to be something that we did because it was the best, but maybe other people couldn't afford it. And so when the vaccine schedule was gradually increased through the 80s, through my childhood, I was already old enough to have avoided most of that increase. And my parents weren't really there for the time when it like it is now. And so me, I guess, when I had kids, I guess the blessing for me was that I had my first two kids in Norway, where the vaccine schedule is not only very, very much more simple, but also administered in a much more common sense sort of way relative to how the parents want to bring up the kid. That stark contrast, when we moved back to the United States in 2016, we weren't planning to have a third child, but we did. And when our daughter came, we were immediately exposed to the stark contrast between how parental guidance or the guidance to parents is given by the medical establishment, by the nurses, by the midwives, and what's provided and what's offered in the United States versus what was offered to us for our two children in Norway just 8 years before. And so it was an extraordinary wake-up call that despite how, let's say, stark the contrast was, both my wife and I did not wake up to the vaccine schedule danger in America until our daughter was quite a bit older. I mean, she was 5 years old when we finally figured it out. And we had delayed some of her vaccines because my wife was breastfeeding, and that was how we were taught or what we were counseled in Norway, is that if you're going to breastfeed your child, then you can postpone the vaccination schedule until you decide to stop breastfeeding, or at least, you know, for a year or two. And so that was the plan. And so maybe that's the only thing that in the end we can look back on and kind of say, whew, we didn't do all kinds of things in the first 6 months of our daughter's life. And as a biologist, that's what's really shocking to me, is that the biology of development and the biology of the vaccine schedule in America was irrelevant to me when I was in Norway. I wasn't thinking about it. And the way that the biology was presented to me as a young father and a young husband and whatever was very different than the biology that was presented to me as an experienced father in America who didn't need to be told how things were, but was still told exactly how they were. And so that extraordinary level of difference, regrettably, wasn't enough. I mean, it wasn't until the pandemic occurred and we were 2 years in and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had already hired me to help consult for his book. And I was already in Zoom meetings when one of these CHD autistic moms said to me, wait a minute, hold on, stop. You haven't seen the movie Vaxxed and you work for us? You got to be kidding me. And so it was only then was I finally woken up to the idea that, hey, dude, you haven't read in yet. You haven't actually realized who you're working for, who you're working with, what these people already know. And then I dove into that. And by the end of my journey through CHD, I'd come to realize that although CHD is composed largely of people with actual skin in the game, i.e. they have kids that were injured by the vaccine or worse, the administrative end of CHD and the way that it is run is not a score a touchdown and the vaccine way. It is in a health freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of choice, very gray area kind of thing. And so they don't have these well-chiseled goals of we want to end this, we want to bring about this, we want to change school lunches. They don't have these kinds of bullet points. And it is disturbing when you get hired by an organization like that and you try to say, we got to sharpen our message, and you get this extremely condescending correction that that's not how these battles are fought. And so I didn't last very long at CHD because of that, because I really think that there are messages that needed to be sent. And if they were sent earlier, I might have not given my daughter a single shot. And it's because they weren't sent, because these movies weren't pushed, because these clear messages were never articulated before the pandemic, we were vulnerable at the beginning of the pandemic to being coerced into the place where we are now, where so many millions of people have been essentially transfected or maybe transfected, and they never should have been, because we should have already been at the stage where it was common knowledge that the vaccine schedule, particularly in America, was somehow out of whack compared to the rest of the free world. And the way that it was administered without exception was also out of whack. And anybody from Norway should have been able to see that. Anybody from America comparing to any of these countries like the Netherlands, Germany, Norway, you could just look into it and see that the sheer number doesn't really make sense. And so all of this stuff, all of this math was available to do. All of these touchdowns were available to score before the pandemic, certainly during the pandemic. And it seems almost dubious at this point that we're still not scoring these touchdowns. And now we're moving on to the idea that maybe the shot saved some people, but it's got this contamination in it. And so we have to blame the contamination for everything. When I lost my job at the beginning of the pandemic because I was making the argument that the methodology as a whole was already known to be inappropriate for a healthy person. Never mind, they just called it an investigational vaccine in a few documents, and then it became a vaccine. It would be like calling a fruit an investigational vaccine, and then everybody now just calls apples a vaccine. I mean, it was that arbitrary because they already had transfection and transformation as product lines for all of these companies already 10 years before the pandemic, because we had already been using DNA and RNA to do all kinds of things on the academic and commercial bench. And so these technologies, we have all been hoodwinked at the beginning of the pandemic into believing that some new miracle was waiting for us, and the pandemic gave them an excuse or enough money to use it. And that's absolutely not the case. This is a long-standing set of methodologies that they already knew exactly how well or not well they would work as a vaccine. And that's the exact reason why, after inventing the technology, Robert Malone never made any money from it. And it never became a product, because this kind of technology always never would have passed a normal clinical trial, because it is not appropriate for healthy humans. It creates all kinds of unknowns, a whole bouquet of possibilities. It's not the same as administering a pure substance, you know, like a poison or not poison, and trying to evaluate the dosage. These are a combination of proprietary chemicals, proprietary processes that bring them together, and then a proprietary level, in the sense of secret, level of contamination with not only impure intended product, but impurities from the production of the intended product. And none of these contaminations, none of these shortcomings, none of these biological impurities were unknowns, because they have been using the process of recombinant DNA and RNA production for 20 years to produce all of the biologics on Earth. All of the biologics on Earth are produced using recombinant DNA that is either directly by the bacterial culture translated to RNA and then proteins, or it is commercially, the DNA is converted to RNA and then applied to whatever cell culture or whatever is going to manufacture the protein that they're ultimately going to purify and make into a biologic. So what you have is a national security, biosecurity state spread across the free world that had a bunch of proprietary technologies that could have never passed traditional, in America, you would term it the FDA kind of clinical trial, and yet had developed these technologies to a very high level in preparations for cancer, in some maybe military applications that we're not aware of. And instead of being very honest and saying that we've been using transfection for a long time and we think transfection is ready to augment your immune system, they just hand-waved all that away and pretended that this was an investigational vaccine. And what's really disturbing is that for the last 5 years, it's become very clear to me that probably one of the main motivations of all of this sort of dissident smoke and mirrors on social media is that they had to protect the non-proprietary nature of this long-standing technology. In other words, all of these companies have made all kinds of intellectual property around the mRNA. It's not the mRNA and the production of it that they are proprietarizing or patenting, but it is the methodologies that bring the lipid nanoparticles together with the mRNA and the machines that do that, the processes that do that, the fluid dynamic design that does that. It's also the actual cationic lipid compositions and the way that those are chemically manufactured that can all be patented. And those are patents which, of course, kind of ignore the elephant in the room that once all of these things come together in the form of a lipid nanoparticle with mRNA in it, it's no different than any other transfection that we've ever used on the academic bench for the last 20 years. And so there has to be this illusion of the unique intellectual property, the unique sort of novelty, if you will, of this technology, because it is imperative that they avoid everyone finding out that it's not novel. In fact, it's completely not novel. And that would mean, of course, that all the shortcomings of it would have already been a long time expected. And in fact, after 5 years, it really does seem that the reason why so many ex-pharma executives, so many DITRA operatives, so many people are stuck on these little parts of the narrative, because their main objective is to make sure that nobody puts all these pieces together and figures out that the transfection and transformation were long-standing methodologies. And under the guise of a crisis called a pandemic, they convinced everybody to just kind of accept these technologies as medicine. And now we can have a 10-year argument about whether or not they need to improve it or how they need to make it. And in fact, we can go into a long discussion about all the ways that's already starting, where they're going to print the RNA and then it won't have any impurities, or they won't use a bacterial culture because that's where some of the impurities come from, or they won't even start with DNA. They'll do something else. It's all an illusion to try and get people to accept that this is a kind of medicine, when in reality, it is so crazy, but you can distill it down to very easy ideas. Intramuscular injection of almost anything to augment your immune system is dumb. There are textbook amounts. You could pile them up and then highlight all of the text which would combine together to describe the reasons why augmenting the immune system of a healthy person through intramuscular injection. I don't know what you would put in there, but I don't think there's anything that you could put in intramuscularly that would usefully augment an immune system. And certainly, most of the time, it would just present a potential for all kinds of hazards, probably most of which we haven't even described yet. And the reason why is because fundamentally, our biology is kind of anti-intramuscular injection. You know, like when you get bit by a snake, that's like the worst case scenario. And so those are worst case scenario injuries. Puncture wounds can become bacterial infections that go septic and kill an animal. So the whole idea of intramuscular injection is counterintuitive to how we should have been thinking about the immune system of our young children already decades ago, but we weren't, because this was inverted. This was inverted when maybe our parents were parents. I don't know when it was inverted, but the whole idea of intramuscular injection, I think, on its face, can be argued as an inappropriate methodology for augmenting a child's immune system and probably also that of a frail elderly person. And so for me, where I think the challenge lies is that there are perhaps hundreds of thousands of highly trained academic biologists that have the requisite knowledge to immediately flip their understanding if they can just hold that thought in their head long enough to go, wait, that actually makes a lot of sense to me. And then if they go back and they look at the history of vaccination in general, if you want to use that as a term that applies to augmenting one's immune system, you will find that there's a very long history of trying to augment the immune system at a barrier, either by inhaling things, swallowing things, or scratching things into your skin. And a lot of times those things kind of sort of work, but only work from the perspective of thinking about your immune system making a change that's not maladaptive. And maladaptive changes in the immune system that expresses chronic diseases, autoimmune disease, whatever, those things, that catastrophic rise has been for the longest time by all of these people obfuscated as a sort of environmental toxins, bad food, no exercise, all of these things. And they are now tripling down on this in America with the election of Trump and the rise of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's all about seed oils. It's all about bad food and processed food and FDA regulations and getting the corruption out of these agencies. And no one will say it that before the pandemic, these people were not arguing that the vaccine schedule was bad, They were arguing that we need safe vaccines. They were not arguing that vaccination is a bad idea or that, like I am, that intramuscular injection seems really dumb. But they were arguing that the injection of particular things, and I think if people were to go back and really look, they would see that we're talking about aluminum, or we're talking about mercury, or we're talking about particular parts of a vaccine rather than the intramuscular injection of this combination of substances being responsible for the harm. So I'm making an argument that I don't know very many people having previously made, but I actually think it's a very important argument to make because it is one that is actually centered in the biology, not in some political ideology like free speech or health freedom or no mandates, but it's actually talking about, okay, if we think about how our immune system is organized, how we understand it works, all the details that we have, and we frame it as we're trying to augment it, we're trying to usefully make an adjustment to it, intramuscular injection would probably be the worst way to do it. I can't think of a worse way except for maybe intrabrain injection. If you were to inject a vaccine into your brain, that would probably be even dumber. But intramuscular injection is pretty stupid. And there's really good argument to make for that because it's exactly the most inner part of the arrangement of the immune system. The immune system is oriented inside out, and that includes inside out, the gut being outside of your body. And that orientation is crucial for the function of the immune system. The immune system needs to be activated in that way so that its arrangement is activated in response and in orientation to it. And the activation of the immune system by intramuscular injection, by definition, is activating the immune system without orientation because it's facing the wrong way. So everything has to be turned around. And by turning it around, there's no location. It's systemic. Essentially, you're trying to augment the immune system by giving it a systemic signal. The only systemic signal I know of is sepsis, where you have an antigen all through your body, and it's a very big problem. And so, again, I'm not a doctor. I'm trying to provoke someone, and this is key. I'm trying to provoke a lawyer. I'm trying to provoke a doctor. I want someone to engage with me so that when I'm corrected, we both gain. And when we sharpen this story, then everybody gains understanding. And right now, there's no lawyer in America who will discuss the legal area with me. And there is no doctor that will discuss the murder and lies that were used to coerce us into taking transfection. So I can't find a biologist to talk about transfection and transformation. I can't find a doctor to talk about the use of supplemental oxygen to create ARDS or acute respiratory distress syndrome in hospitals in America. I can't get a doctor to talk about the 20 years of PubMed articles about how pure oxygen is toxic and how it can cause ARDS. They've known this since the 80s. And so in America, in a lot of places during the panic, the protocol and the shortage of ventilators drove people to act ridiculous, which included giving people supplementary oxygen while they were waiting for treatment. And supplementary oxygen leads to pain and other very acute consequences if it's given at high flow rates. And we have people as high up in the dissident movement as Pierre Corey at some point in the beginning of the pandemic saying that we need to give people liters of oxygen a minute when their pulse ox is low. And this caused people to need to be put on ventilators or to request to be put on ventilators or to accept ventilators because they were in so much pain from the ARDS, from the supplementary oxygen. And man, there is no one in America, no one in America. There's not one MD in America that will address this, even though this is actually the missing piece, because this is the way you can get some people on vents and some people on midazolam and some people without antibiotics with pneumonia and remdesivir. It's a multi-street pathway at this point, and nobody's thinking about the fact that even the comfort ship that was brought to New York City was publicized as going there primarily because why? It had an oxygen plant on it, and they showed on the news people pushing carts of green tanks away from that ship. So the whole narrative was started in America specifically, and all they had to do was murder a few people in America and then call it COVID. And everywhere else lost their mind because of PCR testing. But there were people in America that were murdered and probably elsewhere. I know in Scotland, there's been a good expose of how people were starved and died of cold and urinary tract infection and all kinds of other things, neglect, basically. And they were separated from their loved ones. It was murder, murder, murder in Scotland. And so it should be assumed anywhere that it was murder until proven otherwise. And we need to do a reaccounting of this because in reality, I think all of us have come to the conclusion that there was no risk additive spreading novel pathogen. You want to argue about viruses? I'm all fine with that. I got that all covered too. But I think it's most relevant first to focus on the idea that there were people put in place to make sure that we never figured out in 2020 that all around the world people were being murdered and they were lying about it.
I agree. You covered quite a lot of territory there, but I want to just quickly horseshoe to something you mentioned earlier about CHD and the messaging. And it's very pertinent because Trump has just become your president and warp speed was directly related to him. And there was this very blurry, fuzzy messaging coming from his campaign, not a campaign, well, from him, I suppose. It's your choice. You don't have to get it, but you could, but you can, but you don't have to, you know, that kind of messaging. And then you'll find all those people who are diehard Trump supporters will go, yeah, but it was the plan. You know, we would have all ended up in FEMA camps, et cetera, et cetera. It was that blurry messaging that really bugged me. What do you think happened there with Trump?
It's tricky because all I can do is try to document it. And I've been taking notes for a long time. And I guess my initial off the cuff answer is that there's a lot of little whispers and hints early on in the beginning. So January, February, March of 2020, that people expected the lockdown and the wait for the vaccine to be 18 months to a year. And a surprising number of people had that exact time frame or time horizon in their, you know, speculation. People in weird Twitter circles were already thinking that, and that was already fast. If you could do a vaccine in 18 months, that would already be fast. It's more likely 2 years, so you better buckle up. And that is contrasted quite starkly by this, you know, rollout when it actually occurred. And that is interesting to me simply because we didn't roll out the first vaccine, right? AstraZeneca was the first vaccine in the UK, and we got Johnson & Johnson rolling in America before we got the mRNA really available. And in fact, we had a Saturday Night Live skit in America. I think it was still at the end of 2020 where the old people were joking around with the young people saying that we're going to get Moderna and, you know, only thing that's going to be left for you is Johnson & Johnson. And so there was an interesting circus around this in America. And so they kind of set up already a dichotomy of people that expected it to come out quick or worse. And then other people who were sure that that's good luck with that. There's no way that's coming out. And so it's interesting. It's still very hard for me to tell. I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump was in on it necessarily. I don't think it benefits them. If I say them, I mean like these weaponized piles of money is like what I like to say it. I mean, you know, the Vatican has been a very rich place for a very long time, which means they're probably rich now. And there are other piles of money that have existed for a few hundred years that we should respect and remember and not forget. And, you know, that's why I think we're often pointed to BlackRock and all these other places, even though I'm sure they're important. There are other ways to think about it. And so we don't need to underestimate it.
I think what I was maybe in a roundabout way asking is, do you think that it was a biological pandemic or more of a military psyop, a military operation of sorts?
Oh, it's absolutely not. There was no way that there was a pandemic. It was and remains a military operation, at least from the perspective of social media and the perception management. It's all a military operation, absolutely. What I'm very cautious of, and I identified it a while ago, there is a huge movement to create momentum to blame the U.S. military for the rollout of countermeasures. And I think, although that may be a point of contention, I think what's more important for saving ourselves from what's happening is to first and foremost constantly try to wake more people up to the idea that perception management on social media is a military operation, and we are not free. And engaging on social media and thinking that you are somehow actively engaged in activity that, you know, makes you a good citizen is exactly the opposite of being a good citizen if you're doing that on social media. It's even possible that you're doing it inside of a gymnasium where no one else can hear you and you just don't know it. That's how dark social media actually is. And as far as Twitter or X goes, I have a very dark take on that because in retrospect, I see such an incredibly stark pattern. It's like everything lines up, you know, across miles and miles and miles of time that everybody agreed from 2020 on that the truth and the debate about it or the discussion of it or the uncovering of it was happening more so than anywhere else on Twitter. And that the censorship of Twitter was potentially a very big issue with regard to us solving the mystery of the pandemic. And that Elon Musk has now freed us from these things and enabled us to move forward. What essentially we are being coerced into doing is accepting social media and maybe even X in particular as potentially the modern version of free speech, which is just the most terrifying thing ever. We cannot allow this concept that somehow social media can take the place of free speech or be the primary place where it is expressed. We cannot allow this to happen because if that's the case, I would make the argument that then all social media should be open source and probably even regulated so that we are assured that all the algorithms are, you know, objective and non-political and that all the information moves freely and that no one's information is hampered. And that, of course, you know, it would be an immediate, that's a disaster for any number of reasons, but that's the point I think we need to make is that I think we're at a terrifying precipice here where, you know, Donald Trump wants to put Elon Musk in charge of a bunch of things. Elon Musk has already been in charge of a very, very large bunch of things. And I find that already very implausible. I know a lot of exceptional people in my life and very few of them are heads of, you know, 4 or 5 military contracting companies.
Yeah, people forget that about Elon. I mean, for example, SpaceX, most of it is government contracts.
There's no reason to believe that he has anything to do with it. It could just be the rollout of military technology under the guise of a private entrepreneur. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, it's no different than Jeff Bezos. Is he a genius or was he just a guy who was gifted a proprietary military algorithm that distributes things and he was allowed to roll it out? Because now Amazon, it feels very, very much like it feels very much artificial and very much the same way, holding on to just a very different time horizon. That's the part that bothers me, you know? There should be some footage of Jeff Bezos saying something profound, but there isn't. There should be some footage of of Elon Musk saying something profound and technically insightful, but there isn't. Not even one leaked video of him talking about calculus and like, wow, he's bright. I mean, and that's extraordinary. It's extraordinary because every, you know, they say, oh, he's got Asperger's, all this other stuff, but then it's even more extraordinary that he's got 7 or 8 companies then, isn't it? I mean, this illusion must be broken and it must be broken fast because the children are growing up believing that these people are real and that what they do is real. And if you believe that Elon Musk is real, then what would be the point of, I don't know. It's very wrong. We're in a very big trap right now.
Looking back though, over the last 5 years, I mean, you've done countless conversations about COVID and we're not going to rehash all of that. And I've done plenty also. And I mean, I'm not talking about the biology and all that, but in terms of like the meta lessons that we can learn, and as you say, wake up others, what are those lessons? And in what way would you like people to wake up?
Well, I think the most important one for me is trying to wake up academic biologists to the illusion of the Human Genome Project. As a neuroscientist, I can best describe this using analogies and examples from my own field. Of course, neuroscience in general is already one of these things that bothered me as a term for 20 years, the whole time I was in neuroscience, because neuroscience is a term that actually very aptly describes what's going on in neurobiology. So this is a field that comes from physiology. It comes from biology, physiology, and then now we're looking at the biology and physiology of the brain. And the reason why it became neuroscience in the last, I don't know if it's 15 or 20 years or 10 years, I don't know. It became neuroscience because they wanted to be able to freely bring in people from other fields to essentially generate more knowledge. But it's not knowledge, it's more noise. And as a biologist inside of neuroscience, I was constantly raving about this and ranting about how annoying it was that we were constantly having to work with people who didn't have the requisite knowledge to understand the limits of our own experiments. If you bring a physicist, I could turn it around. If you bring a biologist into CERN and briefly explain to them what's going on there and then ask the biologist for his opinion about what experiment to do, I don't think you would expect to get very much insight from that biologist. And yet, somehow or another, neuroscience has accepted over the last 10 years the idea that people from particle physics can be brought into neuroscience and provide, you know, really huge insights with their math into the function of the brain. And that was, to me, always preposterous because we didn't have enough biological pieces of the puzzle in order to offer anything useful to them. And instead, what happened was that these physicists would come in, and because this was so in, because it was so cool to have a mathematical model, because it was so hard to have a mathematical model with a physics background, that once you could have one, these laboratories started to turn out all these papers with all these proposed mechanisms and all these proposed explanations for brain function that essentially brought us to a state where half of neuroscience being done was essentially useless because they were trapped in this idea that somehow ultimately all their experimental results had to fit into one math model or another, and you needed to have a physicist or some data guy in order to do that. Now 5 years go on past that, and now people have inverted the way that they study the brain, and so now they just try to find ways to collect as much data as possible, make as many what they would call observations as possible so that they can feed back into those existing models and verify them or test what the results are and tweak the models. And so they're two or three steps away from studying the mouse brain anymore or studying the monkey brain anymore, which is, as a biologist, what we were always doing. I never had any misconceptions about the fact that I was working on mouse neurons or monkey neurons, and what I learned was about a mouse. Could it also apply to a human brain? It's possible, but unfortunately for the people around me, I had experience recording from similar tissue in mice, in rats, in three different species of monkey, and also from human glioma patients. And so I could tell anyone and everyone that every electrical recording that I made from every neuron that I'd ever seen in my entire life under my microscope. So I always did the same prep. I make a small piece of brain tissue, or in the case of a mouse, I can take the whole brain out, and I make very precise, thin slices of brain tissue that can be placed under a microscope, remain physiologically active such that the connectivity between the local neurons is preserved, and you can study it, you can stimulate it, you can even make it change in short-term and long-term ways, and all of those mechanisms molecularly are assumed to be active when the brain was whole and when the mouse was running around. And so you do a lot of interesting experiments in that prep. But what I can tell you is if you take that same prep and you make it in a rat, it's very different than a mouse. And that should surprise everybody because the assumption is, of course, that a brain is a brain is a brain. And that's why we cut up all these mice. That's why we have all these knockout mice, because we're studying them so that we can learn about us. And in fact, that's the pollution of the Human Genome Project, that the Human Genome Project many years ago convinced us that we had some map with some landmarks and that these landmarks were so useful that they could be the basis for understanding the entire genome. In other words, imagine that you were going to try to figure out a multi-layered Chinese language-based code. And you had 40 characters that you knew what they meant. And then you told everybody that, okay, now we solved the Chinese alphabet and we're going to, in the next 10 years, we're going to translate all of Chinese literature. Now, of course, knowing that there are more than 1,500 characters in one Chinese language or another already suggests that, wow, that's a pretty bold statement. Already understanding that stroke order matters, but these people don't even know that there's a stroke order. They just said that they have the key to 40 characters. And knowing that there's different versions of characters, you know, all of these complexities, and then never mind that I started the whole analogy with it was a three or a multi-layered code. So that even if you understood the first layer, you would also have to know how that relates to the second and third layer. And these guys don't even know that those two layers are there. And so that is the actual result of the Human Genome Project, that they made some sort of first pass measurement of how complex it was. And the reality was, is that it was a forehead slapping moment because they realized that most of what they understood about genetics had derived from pretty pure signals. So again, I'm just ranting here, but what's coming to head seems pretty good. The Mendelian genetics, for example, everybody thinks that it was just some monk crossing pea plants, but what you don't realize is that it was a monk crossing pea plants for a very long time before he started doing the experiments that are the basis for the Punnett square. In other words, he created very pure genetic strains and not that dissimilar from how we use very genetically pure mouse strains to study biology, because a very genetically pure mouse strain gives us a very consistent molecular signal across time in these animals. That's why it's so handy that they inbreed and don't get sick and die. Well, they do get sick and die, but we don't use them when they're sick and dying. So the point is that that's less possible in rats. You can't do the same kind of breeding schedule in rats that you can in mice because their genome will not tolerate it. In the very similar way that if you look up in PubMed, you will find a paucity of knockout rats and a paucity of knockout monkeys, but you find any knockout mouse you want, because somewhere between a mouse and a rat, the genome gets complicated enough so that these pretty blunt manipulations that work well in mice cannot even function in these higher mammals. And these mammals aren't even nearly as, let's say, high in the physiological complication scale as a primate or as us. And so again, what we're dealing with is a very, very deeply embedded illusion, especially with regard to academic biology and medical biology, where we think, because we were told 40 years ago that 40 years from now, we would understand everything about our genome and we'd be using retroviruses to cure childhood diseases. Those were the mythologies that Robert Malone and Judy Mikovits and Francis Collins and Kevin McKernan and Mark Lander and everybody that was involved in NIH science in the 90s, they were all under the assumption that the computers would get better, our data would get better, all the methodologies would become cheaper, and eventually this brute force, you know, data collection and computer building would result in some understanding that right now we can't predict. And what the reality is that 25 years later, we haven't really made any progress, except it is cheaper to make a lot of DNA, and it's cheaper to make a lot of RNA, and therefore it's cheaper to make a lot of pure protein. But that's all the advance we've done. What they realized is that the human genome is so complicated that the only chance we would ever have to understand it would be to collect every one that's available. And then eventually, if we have an AI that we can feed that data into, maybe we'll be able to find patterns that will be useful. That's their best. That's always been their best option. And you can hear it described 10 years ago. You can hear it described 2 weeks ago. They're all talking the same thing. It's just the time horizon. You know, sometimes it's 40 years, sometimes it's 10 years, but it's all based on this nonsensical idea that the Human Genome Project was a crucial point in time where something had been solved, when in fact it's nowhere near solved. We have no idea. And we have these low-hanging fruit that are a result of experimentally pure systems. And experimentally pure systems include things like very rare childhood diseases. I'll give you a great one, is Angelman's disease. Angelman's disease has been tied to a particular gene with a particular physiological consequences for its absence. Now, this results in a very particular set of childhood symptoms, and some of those symptoms could be misconstrued as being related to another symptom set that's called autism. And so through this absolutely disingenuous representation of what was accomplished in the Genome Project, it has been maybe millions of euros and millions of dollars invested in the study of genetic diseases like Angelman's disease, which I'm sure it's important to understand how that works. Those kids suffer, et cetera. But they are not studying that disease under the pretense of saving Angelman's kids. They are understanding or studying that under the pretense that understanding that will lend understanding to autism and to Parkinson's disease and all the other cognitive disorders that are present in the brain. And that argument is all based on the fallacy, again, that something was accomplished with the Human Genome Project that essentially means that we are the consequence of our genes, or anything meaningful is the consequence of our genes, that evolution is obviously real because of our genes. And in fact, this is how they're going to get us very quickly to the idea that, well, you know, actually, any real medicine would be designed just for you. So we're going to need your genome, and then we're going to design something just for you. We'll make a special RNA just for you. And then now there's no more clinical trials, because personalized medicine will mean that, you know, we made it just for you, so we would never use it on somebody else. And so, you know, if it doesn't work for you, we'll tweak it. And this is actually for sure where they're going. They've been talking about this for 20 years.
Yes, I never thought about that, Jay. That is profound, actually. It's something that didn't ever occur to me. Sort of individualized, what do you call it?
Personalized medicine.
Yeah, that is hectic.
Yes, but they've known this. This is a conscious, I would say, at least 20-year cognitive progression. And I think one of the things that's coming, and it may even be Bobby Kennedy, will eventually get to the stage where they'll say that, you know what, the previous vaccine schedules were kind of crap. And one of the arguments that they have been making since before the pandemic, and I can cite a few people that were particularly making this, is that it was a genetic vulnerability to particular components in vaccines. So Mary Holland made that argument since 2017, that it's not the MMR vaccine in general, but it's probably a particular component of it that harmed her son. James Lyons Weiler, another prominent guy, he also says that they need to test everyone because it's a genetically vulnerable population that we need to identify, and then we can make the vaccine schedule safe. And so I just want to make it doubly clear that I don't think the vaccine schedule can be made safe. I don't think that intramuscular injection is intelligent. It's actually reveals in my mind that the incongruity of that idea, the awfulness of that idea, actually reveals the malevolence.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting, but what you're suggesting is they're creating a type of Overton window within an Overton window. What I mean is they're creating a parameter of, shall we say, safety within another parameter, because now you're discussing a distraction, effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, think about it. If they were going to really try to discredit all of these agencies in America and essentially discredit the American project for the last 50 years, what better way to do it than to slow roll the entire population into accepting that, holy shit, Tony Fauci lied to us about AIDS and AZT. Holy cow, they lied to us about chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue syndrome started right after the Vaccine Safety Act in 86. And yet somehow or another, these same people that were involved in all these same circles are now supposedly saving us from the pandemic, or even worse, saving us from the consequences of the pandemic by speaking the truth. And it's terrifying, because I feel that the inversion will be not that we're going to question the vaccine schedule or put a pause on it, but we're actually going to spend probably billions of dollars testing it to make it safe.
That is terrifying. And it does look like it's coming.
Absolutely, it does. I mean, I don't see any other outcome. They're not going to just pause it for some of the same reasons that you said. It certainly seems that Trump is not anywhere near understanding that it was a bad idea in general, and loves to take credit for having gotten it out faster than anybody expected he could.
Sorry, I'm going to just segue, but there's something I've been wanting to ask you, because you brought it up. Now, I'm not precious about it, just so that we're clear, but you mentioned no virus or virus. Now, that is propped up pretty intensely over the last few years. Tell me a little bit about your position on that. And I'm kind of sympathetic because I've interviewed a number of those guys and they're very decent people. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that I am now thinking of everyone that's potentially involved as getting one particular type of instruction, because I kind of think several times I was given this instruction and I just didn't know it or didn't take it. And the instruction is essentially you are given what Noam Chomsky would call a limited spectrum of debate, and you're asked to stick to it for the best interest of the country or the best interest of your family or for, you know, to help me, I need you to stick to this. And for my personal experience, I think several times I was offered, I was suggested, I was coerced with money or comfort into being the guy who was going to say it was a lab leak. And it was actually at the time when I went from being okay with that position to being so certain that that was a trap, and then watching the reaction of everyone that for the last 3 years had, you know, given me accolades and pretended to think that I was smart, I guess, or, you know, told me I was insightful. But what I noticed is that none of those people were actually promoting my work. None of those people ever used my name. None of those people were subscribers or anything like that. And so as I kept paying attention and thought, okay, well, I mean, the last guy that I believed in was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, I sent him an email. I asked him for a Zoom meeting. And in the meantime, I tried to teach the editorial team of his book as best as I could that actually I think they misled us and that the biologic simplicity is that RNA can't do this. And so the no virus position specifically was one that for a long time I didn't understand because it felt they were neutering it on purpose. I don't know if that's the right word. They were making it weaker than it need to be. So there were a couple different times in 2020 and 2021 where I tried to reach out to the Baileys, actually. I tried to reach out to Sam Bailey in 2020, and she was apparently having a baby. And so she said she would get back to me in 6 months, and then she didn't. And I reached out again, and then she said yes. But then a couple days later, she said no. And then I never heard from her again. And then I got hired by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I was working for him for the book. And I was asked at that time, Mary Holland was actually working for Bobby's campaign. And so not for CHD. And I was not working for CHD. I was working for Bobby's book team, which actually is kind of CHD. But at the time, I didn't know that. So it was at this time that Mary Holland gave me an email from Christine Massey that had been sent to CHD, and it was very kind of curt, and, you know, we have these FOIAs, and CHD won't do this, and CHD won't do that. And Mary, at the time, asked me if I would be willing to try and pen an email which could respond to this, because Merrill had tried before, and Mary had tried before, but these people don't seem to listen to them, so maybe I could take a shot. And because I was, you know, thinking that I was the dude, and I was the hero guy, and so I said, sure, I know exactly what I need to say to him. And so I did, to the best of my ability, explain what I still think is the truth. And it was the same basic thing that made me rethink the lab leak and become very sure that there is no such thing. And it is all from this time when I was working for Bobby in the book. He asked me very specifically to define for him what infectious clones are. And crazy enough, dude, this is still the one data point where I believe that at some point in time, Bobby did not know what was going on. He might not even know what's going on now, because he asked me to define infectious clones. And it is that 3 weeks of work where once I started to figure out, wait, is this true? I actually spent two more weeks trying to prove myself wrong because I was so afraid to come back to Bobby and tell him what I had found. The basic gist of it is that infectious clones is a term that you can look up on PubMed and it will bounce out hundreds, if not thousands, of papers. And all of these papers contain one particular methodology. I think when I was ranting earlier, I said that one of the only real consequences of the Human Genome Project is that we are able to make DNA and RNA very cheaply now. And we can make DNA strands up to, say, 3,000 bases long at a very high fidelity level by what is essentially molecular printing. And I could kind of draw a cartoon about how that works sometime. But the point is that we can make very pure DNA pretty cheap now. We have all kinds of very commercially developed ways to link those DNAs together so that we can make very long strands of completely synthetic and quite pure DNA, which, you know, using any number of standard methodologies could be converted to RNA and could be converted to protein. And like I said earlier, all monoclonal antibodies are made like this. All biologics that are, you know, pharmaceutical products that are essentially derived from proteins, they're all made like this. They start with a DNA. It's very pure. They either make it synthetically or derive it synthetically and then grow it up in a bacterial culture. They take that DNA out of the bacterial culture and react it with a commercial RNA polymerase to make the RNA. And then they can apply that RNA directly to a cell culture, and the cell culture will make the protein. After the protein is made, they need to remove all other material from it in order to make it the pure protein. And the way that they remove the DNA and the RNA from any preparation like that for the last at least 10 years is called anion exchange chromatography. And so if you're making a monoclonal antibody, one of the most reasons why monoclonal antibodies are so expensive is because after you manufacture the monoclonal antibody, it has to be pure. It cannot have any DNA or RNA or endotoxins from the bacteria in the sample. Otherwise, the entire batch either needs to be run through that same process again, which it won't help anymore because it's such a low concentration, or it has to be burnt, you know, discarded. And so the whole point of biologics and why they are expensive and why they are, in general, not something that everybody can get at the hospitals because of the strict requirement for them to be pure in order for them to be the substance that they are approved to be. And not only that, but the incredible expense and loss rate of that production method, because at the end you have to do this one-time step of anion exchange chromatography. And if at the end it's contaminated, the whole batch is gone. So that issue is interesting because, of course, I said DNA to RNA to the protein. Well, that means that in order to make all these RNA shots, lo and behold, these pharmaceutical companies already had the infrastructure to make DNA and RNA. So they are saying, oh, we have to retool our factories and get everything running, and I don't know if we can make this quota, was all just an elaborate illusion to justify Jurassic Park level spending when they already had all the equipment to make DNA and RNA, and they just didn't have to purify it anymore. And they knew already that the only way they could purify it was with anion exchange chromatography, which would not separate RNA from DNA, useless for making pure RNA. And so the contamination of DNA was known. It was a known limitation. Anyone like Kevin McKernan, who's been in molecular biology since he was in high school and working for the Human Genome Project since he dropped out of college, is someone who would have known that the manufacturing process was known to be, it had to be contaminated, would have known that the purity level that they could reach using those processes was limited. And he knew that already from the very beginning. So now to come out and say that they were contaminated with double-stranded DNA is like saying that your teenager crashed into a tree having drank a bottle of whiskey and you're blaming him for the beer can in the back. It's like, well, duh, you knew if he drank that bottle of whiskey, he was going to crash the car. So don't say that the beer can is the problem.
But hold on. Pull it back into layman's terms. So what are you saying?
I'm saying that there was at no point in this time frame where anybody with a meaningful opinion should have thought that this technology could be rolled out in healthy humans. So everybody that participated in it in one way or another is still guilty. I mean, because they murdered people and lied about it and then had this discussion about what this new technology was. Robert Malone has been going around the earth for 5 years calling transfection and transformation gene therapy. And the main reason he's doing it is because he's helping to protect all this intellectual property that's behind all of these products that will remain behind these technologies for a long time. That shouldn't be proprietary technology. It shouldn't be patentable because this garbage was already available as products on the academic bench for 20 years.
What I'm asking is, does SARS-CoV-2 exist? I was asking a more radical question about viruses and no viruses.
Okay. I would say my main argument against that question having an answer is, number one, the testing that we did at the beginning of the pandemic is not equivalent to whatever they purport to be doing now. At the beginning of the pandemic, most of the tests that were rolled out in America and around the world were aspecific for a coronavirus in general. And so if you just take the idea of a coronavirus, never mind all RNA viruses, if you take the idea of a coronavirus and look where it comes from in the scientific literature, there isn't that much evidence for a coronavirus being a separate entity. The signal of RNA could be there. And the most important point I think I can make is that we have not just a little bit, but we have absolutely zero data about how these tests would have worked in 2018. It could be that the tests that we used in America, and there were over 220 different diagnostic tests available in America in 2022 to diagnose COVID. And if we were to able to use a time machine and take those 220 products back to 2018, we could find exactly the same positive-negative ratio, the same positivity related to illness as we did this year. But we can't because there's no data, and there's none. There's no data in the literature about coronaviruses in circulation. There's no data where they were tracking all these endemic viruses. Remember, we're told that OC43, NL40 or 67, HKU, whatever. There's four or five endemic coronaviruses that are supposedly in circulation in the background, but these virologists aren't tracking their genomes. Nobody's tracking any of these because they can't, because it's part of a background that has been misconstrued as a high fidelity viral signal. And so instead of saying that there's all this noise, like, you know, you turn on a ham radio and you claim it's all data. If you turn on a ham radio and you turn up the volume, you hear fuzz. And in the background, there might be some signals, but you can't hear it. And then you claim that with this magic test, you can pull signals out of the noise. But they've never bothered to characterize the noise. They've never shown it to us, told us what the background signal is. And in fact, one of the bedrock principles of the pandemic is that the background wasn't there and now it is there. It's like a signal, yes or no. And that is what the no virus people got right. They absolutely are correct that these signals aren't high fidelity and they don't show up and then you can follow them around. There's no evidence for that at all. And so if these are phenomenon, they need to be studied as phenomenon that are a part of us in the similar way that you would never try to study the exhaust of automobiles as separate from the automobile. You would never try to measure the temperature and composition of the exhaust of an automobile and claim that the exhaust composition was somehow responsible for how fast the car was going or whether it crashed or not. And yet, if this RNA that we're seeing is either natural signaling or, as some of the no virus people have argued, kind of an exhaust signal or a waste signal or whatever, I don't care what it is. The bottom line is that it's a background signal and it's probably very loud. And at the start of the pandemic, all that would be required is a concerted lie about not being a background signal, but it being some very high fidelity measurement that you need to buy our products to measure. And so, again, the no virus people got running in a hamster wheel about culturing and isolation and FOIA requests instead of saying that this is such a bad illusion. And the way they got away with it is with murder. They should have just been saying murder is the they're murdering people because there is no virus. And I tried. This is where we go back to it. So Mary asked me to write this letter. And in that letter, what I specifically said was that the no virus people and CHD could come together under the banner that there are no RNA viruses that can pandemic, but pharmaceutical companies have been able to make commercial grade DNA and RNA for years And that's all you need for a PCR signal. So one of the things that I told the no virus people is that the sequence itself could have been planted by a teenager. A teenager could buy the kit to make the DNA of the spike and make enough of it so that it would, any PCR test that swabbed the counter that it was on would be hot as fire. And so if you wanted the Chinese to find a signal that you wanted an excuse to put in your countermeasure, you could make that with pennies and put it any number of places, including in a market if you wanted to. And the Chinese would publish it. And then Moderna could say, hey, look, they found a DARPA protein. We might as well use it. And so the worst case scenario for me is a national security state that had a designer protein that they wanted the excuse to transfect us all with. And so the excuse that they would use is that, wow, we found this virus and it's got this spike protein, and the spike protein has this very interesting sequence that we're all going to talk about for a long time because we're going to make antibodies to it. And we're going to make all the new products specifically focused on this one protein out of 31. And there's no real good argument for it except that we're just going to do it. And so every single rollout of a coronavirus countermeasure, sorry, a SARS-CoV-2 countermeasure was focused on this one protein with this one sequence that by all measures could have been planted anywhere they wanted to for pennies. That's for certain. And instead of that being a discussion point that the no virus people could grind into the ground for the last 3 years, they responded to that letter with, show us the proof, send us papers, Cooey is as full of it as you guys are. And then they did a 5-person response to my letter calling me just one of the people that believes in the bullshit. And I tried so hard in that letter to bring CHD and virus people together on one idea that they murdered people to lie about the vaccine schedule and to lie about the fidelity of this virology biology.
Yeah. So what you're effectively saying is, you know, we got to find the common ground rather than find the reasons that separate us.
Well, there is extremely good common ground that nobody wants to take for the last 5 years. And I've been trying to push people to take it. Because again, the no virus people could also make the argument that one of the reasons they told us this magical mythology of a novel virus spreading from a mud puddle to all the white-tailed deer in North America is that they needed to hide the dangers of the vaccine schedule. They needed to hide the dangers of this well-known technology, transfection. I've been begging them to add this to their repertoire for years, and they just ignore me. I mean, I don't want credit. I don't want them to say my name. I just want them to say that it's transformation and transfection. I want them to say that RNA cannot pandemic. The magic of DNA that Watson and Crick found is that it's double-stranded, and that double-stranded nature of DNA makes it very easy to copy, and it makes it very easy to find errors, because if there's an error, it won't go together in the middle. It won't match because the bases don't match. And this is the incredibly, and you know, it's so important. This is the central dogma of biology, because this goes to RNA and this goes to protein, right? So the point is, this central dogma is all based on the magical qualities of the double-stranded RNA molecule and all of the magical qualities that it imparts on the consequences that follow it. Because the RNA doesn't have to be perfect, because the DNA is perfect. And so what's very interesting about RNA as the basis for a coronavirus pandemic is that at no point in time during the life cycle of a coronavirus is there DNA used. And so it's very, very dubious, and this is something from my own lifelong academic biology training that became very obvious to me as I investigated infectious clones, was that the reason why they need infectious clones is that if you gather RNA in the wild, you're never going to gather very much of it. It's going to be very heterogeneous too. It's not going to be very pure. And so even if you claim to have found a signal of RNA in the wild, if you want to study it in your cell culture, you're going to have to resort to DNA to manufacture it in order to get enough RNA to say that you're studying what you say you're studying. There is no virology based on wild viruses, not RNA.
That's fascinating. But can I ask you just a related question? And this is a question that I grapple with, is one that I find more interesting than whether or not viruses exist. Can I catch something from you?
Yes, I think so. But the reason why is the same reason why you probably wouldn't like to kiss me. It's because our bodies are sending immunological signals. We're also sending pheromones. We're sending hormones. All this chemical signaling includes RNA. And my guess is that it is possible in a household for our kids' immune system to send an RNA, which for a limited time may cause our immune system to react with mucus or with coughing or whatever. I think it's also possible that there's RNA in nature that does it. But the most important thing that I think nobody ever thinks about is that your lungs and your gut are completely populated with bacteria. And bacteria are constantly exposed to and exchanging their own version of viruses. And in fact, the biology of bacteriophages is probably the high-resolution biology that has been misconstrued as also being present in our own biology. So in other words, very similar to how yeast and the protein folding of yeast has been misconstrued as representing the same thing as prions in humans, I think it's very visible in the early virology books that most of the principles of virology were discovered in bacteriophage experiments. And then when they found RNA in our own preparations associated with symptomology, they assumed that there must be a similar mechanism happening in our bodies, which are these viruses. But the key biological misconstruing there is thinking of the bacteriophages as being separate from the bacteria, because they're not. Bacteria and bacteriophages are all part of the same pattern integrity, very similarly to how different haploid and diploid plants are all part of the same pattern integrity as they move through their life cycles. Phages are part of a bacterial life cycle. And so if you think of it more like that, then another very easy source of what we are being told is a contagion would actually be bacteriophages moving from my bacteria to yours. And then your bacteria very briefly producing a protein or producing a signal, some other signal that your immune system will react to. And so one of the things we never talk about is the idea that our bacteria in our gut and our bacteria in our lungs are in a constant state of balance and imbalance with our immune system. And if they start to do things, release proteins or other signals which cause our immune system to react, we would never be able to differentiate between my gut bacteria influencing your gut bacteria or my lung bacteria influencing your lung bacteria from the illusion of virology if we never even acknowledge that that's possible. We never test for it. We never look for it. And they're not. Nobody's looking at that.
Just quickly, what do you mean by immune system?
The immune system is the T cell, B cell, antibody, macrophages, all these independently identified components of the blood and lymph, which can be responsible for fever, can be responsible for inflammation, and all these other things that can cascade out of control, including autoimmune diseases like, I don't know, attacking the myelin in MS or the joints in some forms of arthritis.
But it's not some sort of separate entity that exists on its own. It's part of the human.
No, and I think that's a valid argument. I mean, I think, you know, in general, it's a little disingenuous to say that, though, because we have to, in order to try and parse what's going on in our body, it was useful to think of the immune system as meaning something different than the digestive system. But no one, I don't think anybody would make the argument that the digestive system is separate from the immune system functionally. That's ridiculous. But in order to discuss components usefully, we give names to them.
I wouldn't be
too enticed by the idea that they're pulling the wool over our eyes by calling it the immune system. I think what we ought to do is say that they're pulling the wool over our eyes by pretending that they understand anything about our biology well enough to use intramuscular injection to alter us. That's the most ridiculous part.
Jay, where can I follow your work?
GigaOhmBiological.com. GigaOhm is G-I-G-A-O-H-M. It means a million ohms. It actually comes from the methodology that I used to record from neurons all way back when. And it sounds really ridiculous, but I was actually making t-shirts for patch clamp physiologists with the symbol Giga Ohm on it while I was still a professor, thinking it was just a funny joke that I could give people these gifts. And then it became this thing. So I have a website, GigaOhmBiological.com, all one word. And then I also have a peer tube, which is at stream.gigaohm.bio. And if you're not familiar with PeerTube, it's just like a YouTube clone that you run yourself. And it's really nice because there's no algorithm, there's no logging. You can just find my videos and the algorithm won't serve you up Joe Rogan next or anything like that. But yeah, I'm just trying to now, my main thing is I'm trying to reorient myself from fighting against these Scooby-Doo bad guys to, I actually think it's pretty important now to try and offer an alternative to young people, maybe high school biology students or maybe freshman college biology students, to offer them a short course alternative that kind of outlines what I argued before, that the Human Genome Project, if it's malevolently used to misconstrue understanding, we can create a lot of knowledge that's actually not useful. It's not really knowledge at all. I know it happened in neuroscience. My guess is it's happening all throughout medicine. And we have to be aware that going forward, that's what they're going to continue to do until they finally tell us the truth, which is your doctor needs to start with your full genome and then, you know, give it to the NIH, and then the doctor will get instructions after the computer responds. So hopefully we can stop that before it's implemented.
Jonathan J. Cooey, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're welcome.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.